everybody. Ryan Rucco, CC Sabathia with you. A brand new episode of R2C2 coming your way. Today, we get to chat with Theo Epstein. You know, we got a lot of attention and amazing feedback last year for our pod with Theo, who obviously is an all-world, highly decorated baseball front office executive guiding the Red Sox and the Cubs to the breaking of their curses and presiding over multiple championships when he put together his time at both franchises. But he is currently now been in his role as a consultant to the commissioner and with Major League Baseball for the last couple of years. And we talked with Theo at length last year about the rules that Major League Baseball was going to be testing in the minors in different places and the different aims of those rules and, you know, the potential pitfalls and how they were going to be monitoring them. And Theo promised us he would come back on and digest what they learned and what they were going to move forward with. And we know there are some significant rule changes for this upcoming season. Larger bases. There's going to be shift restrictions. And there's going to be a pitch clock. And so Theo is going to detail for you exactly why those things are happening. He breaks down with just incredible eloquence and precision why each of those things makes sense right now, and also what is still being examined further for baseball and what they've already put in the trash and said, all right, look, this isn't going to work. We tried it. It's just not a fit. So I can't recommend this podcast enough for anybody who is interested in the future of baseball, where the game goes, and why they are implementing the rules that they're implementing. Theo is incredible. He's going to make you want him to be the GM of your team, whoever you root for. But he is, I think, serving an incredible purpose for the growth of the sport in his current role with Major League Baseball. So part two, a year and a half later, of our conversation with Theo Epstein, just recently recorded, you're about to hear. Hope you're enjoying the World Series. It's been incredible watching what the Phillies have done in these playoffs. Like, they probably would have been the last team on the National League power rankings if people were taking bets on who was going to go to the World Series. They may have been the last team in the National or American League if you were taking bets on who was going to be able to go to and win the World Series. And yet here they are on the precipice of being able to make that happen. It's incredible what Bryce Harper has done in these playoffs. Is incredible. And even though that fan base is tough to root for after the stories I told you on our episode with Rob Thompson, the way the Philly fans are, I feel so happy for Rob, a great baseball man who spent three decades learning, growing, developing, and now getting this opportunity. How about Kevin Long, who is another great dude who now has taken four separate franchises to the World Series? Clearly, he has helped these teams learn not only, you know, just how to access the best aspects of their offensive talent, but how to hit it this time of year. You know, that's very significant as well. So we will be all over the World Series whenever it concludes. We obviously will be on free agency whenever it begins. And we hope you thoroughly enjoy this conversation CC and I both had with Theo Epstein about everything Major League Baseball is going to be implementing next year, what still might be to come, really interesting nuances with the potential automatic balls and strikes and when that could be implemented. I think you're going to really enjoy this conversation. And remember, if you have not gone back and listened to Dusty Baker, Rob Thompson, a couple of figures obviously very relevant to the World Series, we've had them both on recently, you can go back and go on our YouTube page at R2C2. Or check us out on wherever you get your podcasts. All those episodes are available, and I would highly recommend them because they both were amazing. Without further ado, here's Theo Epstein on R2C2. Well, Theo, first of all, We just have to say thank you for being a man of your word. You told us you'd come back on with us to assess all the potential changes that could happen after you laid out for us what the league was looking at. And here you are. So the episode last time was one of the most highly received episodes that we've ever had. So many people even throughout the game came up to me and see at different points talking about how much they enjoyed it. So we're excited for this one. Thanks for being back, man.
Cool. Well, your word is your bond. So happy to be back. And I enjoyed it. And I think people like talking about, rule changes and the game of baseball and their favorite version of the game. And it's not, people don't tend to agree all the time, but it always leads to a good conversation. I think everyone in the end just wants what's best for baseball. So happy to talk about it.
Amen. So, you know, one of the things we talked about, and C and I talked about it last episode, was the rule changes that have been implemented and why they have been. And you talked about kind of the different things that are being looked at in the minor league level and going through an evaluation period. So I guess the first thing I'd ask you, for the things that you're going to have now at the major league level, we'll start with the shift. What data bore out that allowed you guys to feel confident that, you know, banning the shift or requiring two infielders on each side of second base to be on the dirt would be the right move to, you know, help be a step towards your guys' goal of more action and putting the game back in the hands of the players?
Yeah. Well, it's funny you should start with the shift, because, you know, the shift regulation is actually the one that I think will move the needle the least in terms of style of play, perhaps, or certainly not the most. It won't be the most impactful in terms of style of play we're trying to create. And there are a lot of good arguments in favor of the regulation, and there are some strong counter arguments. You know, I think reasonable people can certainly disagree. So I'll kind of run through some of the arguments in favor of it and why we made the move, and then I'll run through the counter arguments, and I'll get to the data at the end and be kind of curious to hear what you guys think about it. But in the end, I think, you know, a number of arguments were compelling to the Joint Competition Committee that ended up voting for the shift restrictions. You know, number one is probably just in terms of relatability to fans and restoring a traditional aesthetic in the game. You know, fans, and this is not data driven per se, other than some polling and surveying of the fans, but you know, fans grew up knowing where the shortstop and second baseman are intuitively, instantly, and fans know or used to know what a base hit looks like off the bat, and that's changed in the last decade or so, and we hear about it from fans, fan polling backs up that it's not a sort of a really welcome trend to most. So the shift regulations, anti-shift regulations, should make the game more relatable to fans and restore that aesthetic that they're used to. And that's been traditional for most of history of the game. Number two, and this is the one that I think is most important to me personally, is just what it means in terms of putting the premium on athleticism back in place for defensive infielders. Everyone talks about what the shift means for hitters, but I think it's overlooked what it means for defense and athleticism defense. So when you're shifted, infielders are bunched up, you can get away with putting less athletic players, especially second basemen, out on the field. You know, you saw a lot of like third base types signed to play second base in certain areas, because, you know, you can just hide them in the shift. And with the shift restrictions in place, what we found in the minor leagues is that infielders just have more room to roam, more room to make plays at the extremities of their range. And infielders end up loving that freedom. They love the anti-shift restrictions, you know, because they feel like it puts them back in a position to make game-changing plays. And that puts the game a little bit more back in the hands of the players. That's another reason is, ultimately, I think fans really like when games are decided. We talked about this last time, but, decided by players making that big second baseman, making that big play up the middle, not by whether your front office has the perfect algorithm, you know, to have them positioned in exactly the right place. And then the last thing or the last couple of things that shift restrictions will improve the ball and play environment for left-handed hitters, especially. And the data does bear that out. The average batting average on balls in play has been way down for left-handed hitters in recent years. And then actually non-shifted environments themselves could encourage a few more balls in play. Strikeout rates and walk rates tend to be higher for shifted at-bats than for non-shifted at-bats, even when you adjust for contacts and the individual matchup. So, wow. You know, just slightly encouraging more balls in play and making the in-play environment a little bit easier for left-handed hitters. And the data shows that, assist left-handed hitters. A few more balls are going to play. We're talking probably, 5 points of BABIP, 10 points of BABIP, nothing earth shattering. That's pretty significant, but nothing earth shattering. It's really hard to tell exactly how it'll play out at the big league level because there's just not as much shifting in the minor league. So we're going to learn a lot from the first year of this in the big leagues. Now, look, the counter arguments are real. I know, the one I'm most concerned about and the committee was most concerned about is that, eliminating the shift tends to benefit a certain subsection of hitters, left-handed three true outcome type hitters who don't exactly align with the goals of increasing the amount of balls in play and athleticism on the field. So that's a potential unintended consequence, creating more of those type of three true outcome hitters, pull first hitters that we're keenly aware of and something that you had to balance out with the benefits. And then there's just like a philosophical argument based on historical precedent and sort of a competitive philosophy that teams should have the right to position fielders wherever they like. And then concern about downstream impacts, like we talked about. You can't necessarily know how eliminating the shift will change hitter incentives, pitcher incentives, and different behaviors. And so, no one's going into this thinking that this is the answer. Clearly, with all these rule changes, we have to keep our eyes wide open and make sure, we're open to adjustments. There's no pride of authorship on any of this stuff that if there are downstream impacts that we didn't anticipate that we can correct for them. And then the last concern is just, I think we all know the shift is not the root cause of the negative trends that we're trying to address for. I think the strikeout rate, for example, and pitcher dominance is a much bigger reason for, average being down and the lack of action in the game. So you don't want to lose the forest for the trees here. But in the end, look, we've studied it. I think we know enough about it to know that the impacts aren't severe, but that they make for a little bit easier in-play environment. And the bottom line is the league is hitting 243 under the current rules. Non-pitchers are hitting 243 and the pitchers aren't hitting anymore. So that's the lowest non-pitchers have ever hit in the history of baseball, 243. And in 68, the year of the pitcher, I think non-pitchers hit 245. So we have an all-time low batting average in the history of the game. And that, I think, lends us to believe that even though there's a bit of uncertainty, even though it's not the crux of the issue, the shift, it's probably better to try something new than maintain the status quo, especially if you go in with the attitude that you don't have all the answers and open to making adjustments as you go.
No, I mean, I think you said a few things in there. I think the biggest, a couple of biggest things is, fans knowing what a base hit was off the bat. And even, getting that athleticism back where you thought it was a base hit off the bat, but you'd be like, oh no, the shortstop made a great play. That kind of keeps you in the game and, keeps you excited about the game. And one of the one of the downside things I heard is we've been, going around and meeting with teams and stuff. And guys were saying, well, can we just move a left fielder and put him in short right field? And then that creates a shift again. But for me, any of my left fielders that I play with, if you put them in short right field, they ain't making the fucking play. Johnny Damon, Chris Young, I don't want them guys in short right field. You know what I'm saying? So, I don't think that that will make a huge difference either.
Yeah, and look, I think teams, you make a great point. Like, teams are going to try different things to get around the rule, to circumvent it, and to get their fielders in the best possible position. And they should, and that's great. And, the rule as it's written provides a lot of flexibility to still position your fielders. You just can't have more than two on either side of second base, and you can't start an infielder past the outfield dirt or the edge of the infield dirt in the outfield. But look, if you take your left fielder and position him in short right field, yes, you have three quote-unquote infielders on the right side again, but at a great cost. Yeah. You now have two outfielders.
Yeah.
And so that's going to, you're going to see it, you know, a tremendous decrease in hit prevention and run prevention on any balls in the air to the outfield when you're trying to cover that big outfield or outfield with 2.5, defenders instead of 3. So look, I think there'll be some circumventions that work as designed, some that don't work as designed. And I just think we're going to have to stay open-minded about it. And the disruption is probably good, right? Like the game has gotten really homogenous and every team is shifting now just about the same way. You're seeing an increasing trend towards even towards like 4 outfielders at times for certain guys who hit the ball in the air a lot and do a lot of damage. That's not something I think aligns with what we want to see. That won't be possible under the new regulation. So, better, I believe, even though it's not the root cause of what we're looking at here, and we can get into some rule changes that more directly address the root cause, I think it's better to try something new. And I applaud the Joint Competition Committee for being open-minded to it.
I guess, Theo, it sounds like there is some element of, hey, this could have some positive effects towards what we want. We have enough data that feels like it supports it. We might as well try it, which almost to me in itself is encouraging, because that feels like a deviation from at least the stigma that's existed about baseball forever, right? And a reluctance to change its ways and a real tie to traditional, whatever its traditions are. So
That's right.
Like, because you guys aren't sitting there saying, no, we need 5 years of evidence before we can make this change. You're saying, hey, we're not totally sure this is definitely going to do what we want, but there's enough to make us say, let's try it.
Yeah, that's right. And look, there was a lot of testing. I mean, there have been over 8,000 minor league games worth of testing done for these rule changes. That's 3.5, the equivalent of 3.5 major league seasons total. So I think it was important to experiment with the rules in the minor leagues. That's something the commissioner really encouraged, and I'm glad we did. But you still, I think, I don't think it's healthy to get to a point where you think you have it all figured out. You think you have the perfect rule. You're going to have to make adjustments as you go. And the data does show, like, it's imperfect data. As I said, it's not a great laboratory in terms of testing for the shift, because just the shifting and the defensive positioning information in the minor leagues can't hold a candle to what you have in the big leagues. But those who benefited most, as you would expect, were left-handed pull hitters who are traditionally shifted the most, and they're the ones who saw the greatest increase in batting average on balls in play. And because there's more shifting in the big leagues, I think, the impact will probably be a little bit greater in the big leagues than it was in the minor leagues. And the disruption will probably, after a series of adjustments on both sides and maybe adjustments to the rule if necessary, I'm confident we'll end up serving the game well.
See, what was your initial reaction when you saw the pitch clock rule going through?
No, I was excited about the pitch clock. I think the pitch clock is going to be the biggest rule change that you're going to see more action. I think velocity is going to drop from the pitchers. I think the batting average is going to go up from the hitters. Obviously not being able to just take your time and max effort, throw a pitch, wait 40 seconds, walk around the mound, max effort. So I think, obviously the pace of the game is going to improve, but I don't think, people were really worried about the pace of the game. If you get action, I don't care how long the game is, as long as I have action. If I got shit moving around and, people are, moving and stuff happening in the game, I don't care how long the game is. So I think, having a pitch clock is going to speed up and put more action in the game. And I think that's what is going to excite fans a little more.
Theo, how about the pitch clock? Why'd you guys feel confident moving with it ahead for the major league season next year?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with CC. I think the pitch timer is going to be the single most impactful rule change. And honestly, I think it's a huge win for baseball. There was, and to an extent still is, a lot of skepticism about this rule from people who haven't seen it. Mm-hmm. The people who have not seen games with the pitch timer tend to object to it because of this notion that, part of what makes baseball great is not having any clocks on the field, not having the sense of time, needing to get 27 outs. And I completely understand where they're coming from. That is one of the unique and romantic things about baseball. And I shared those concerns until I started seeing a lot of games with the pitch timer. Like the testing, and this is where the you know, 8,000 games worth of testing for the rule changes really comes in handy. Like, the testing has been a massive success for this version of the pitch timer. You know, again, as CC was saying, it's not all about length of game, but length of game does matter for something. And it reduced game times by, about 25 minutes, depending what level you're looking at. And, major league games are, 3 hours and 7 minutes or so. And if you ask fans, and we have the polling data, what the ideal game length time is, they say 2.5 hours. So this gets us, a lot closer to ideal game length. But beyond what it meant for time of game, it's the pace and the rhythm of the game that is created by the pitch timer. And it's wonderful. It's the best comparison is if you happen to attend a game and two pitchers who are working, who happen to work really quickly, like the Mark Burley.
I was about to say Burley.
Yeah, those guys, that school of pitching, it's like you got one of those working on either side and the game just moves quickly and naturally with this fantastic pacing to it that you don't even notice it. You know, the pitch timer, fans stop noticing the pitch timer after a couple innings of witnessing it. And it pulls, fans were sort of slightly in favor of the pitch timer if they've never seen it. And then the more you see it, the more games you watch on minor league baseball TV or the more minor league games you attended, the more you like it, up to the point where fans who've seen, enough games, I think, favor the pitch timer 88%, for those who've experienced. So it creates this incredible pacing and rhythm that I think fans are going to love. That's just better for the game. And then what's amazing is it creates a better style of baseball as well. There's some evidence that strikeout rate goes down with the pitch timer because pitchers, are in better rhythm. Hitters are ready to go, ready to swing the bat. Walk rate goes down with the pitch timer. Pitchers are throwing more strikes. I think we've seen better defense overall, the data indicates, and anecdotally it looks like that because defenders are more into every pitch. They don't have as much time to kill between pitches. They can stay on their toes. So batting average is up significantly with the pitch timer, but the run environment isn't dramatically higher. It's not like this is a gimmick that's going to change the way the game is played. It's just more of what we like, more balls in play, more base hits, more great defensive plays, more action. Fans right now have to wait more than 4 minutes between balls in play in the big leagues. And that's going to go dramatically down with the pitch timer. And I think the best evidence besides just how well the pitch timer pulls among fans, players, staff, everybody is just if you look at how quickly players adjusted to it. When we first rolled out the pitch timer at the beginning of the year, there were a handful of violations per game as it took pitchers and hitters, a couple of weeks to adjust to it. But once we got 3 weeks out on pitch timer, we were down to less than half a violation per game for both teams combined. So, the automatic ball, automatic strike was awarded, once every two games. So for each team, that's once every four games that they're suffering an automatic strike or an automatic ball. So, I talked to a number of former colleagues, like old scouts, crusty guys who've been in the baseball for like 40, 50 years, who wanted nothing to do with this and had a few choice words for me, when they first heard it was being rolled out in the minor leagues. And like after a handful of games with the pitch timer, they were calling me back saying like, I love this. We need this in the big leagues tomorrow. This reminds me of, the way baseball was played when I was growing up. Like, why can't we have it tomorrow in the big league? So I would just encourage fans who are skeptical of it to, first of all, to go see a minor league game. We're running late. I think there's only a few, minor league playoff games left, but there's some minor league games you can see on TV, Arizona Fall League, and just give it a chance next year because it fades to the background pretty quickly and you're just left with the byproduct, which is, a beautifully paced, exciting baseball game with more of what you like and less of what you don't like.
And I think, you're not trying to speed up the actual game. You're just trying to speed up the dead time in between action. You know what I'm saying? Like, having a chance to talk to some of the older guys. Like, I had a chance to talk to Justin Upton. He played in AAA this year. Talking to Dylan Betances. He pitched in AAA this year. And the first thing they say is, oh, I don't like the pitch timer. But then you start talking to him about, you get into a conversation with him, and by the end of the conversation, Dylan was like, well, it wasn't that bad. It was just at the beginning, you know, I had to start. But once they get into the pace and start figuring out, then it's not a problem. And it actually gets you into a better rhythm. Like, but at the beginning of the conversation with Dylan Betances, he was like, he was all about hating the pitch clock. By the end, he was like, oh, yeah, but I did get in a better rhythm, and I was throwing more strikes, and I felt a lot better. So it's just one of those things where I feel like older guys are going to be resistant to it just because it's something new. But I think once everybody gets into the rhythm of it, they're gonna love it.
And with CC, we saw that too. I think, you know, it's natural that veteran players who've had a lot of time in the big leagues are maybe a little bit more resistant to something so new like the pitch timer, because by definition, they've become the best in the world playing under a certain set of rules. So like the status quo works because for them individually, because they've you know, had tremendous success under this current set of rules. And so when you introduce something new, that can be challenging. And I completely empathize with that. And that makes perfect sense. But if you look at veteran players who've, as you say, gone on rehab assignment or spent a lot of time talking to guys from AAA who've gone up to the big league, like the more they experience it, the more they're around it, the more open-minded they are to it. So look, I think the adjustment period is going to be real. You know, the first 2 or 3 weeks, it's going to be, I'm taking a trip to the other side of the world.
it's going to have to be the first 3 weeks of spring training. You guys are going to have to be super strict. Like the first hitter in spring training, get in the box or it's a strike. You know what I'm saying?
Enforcement is key. Yeah. Like there has to be enforcement from day one. Umpires are going to have great training and education, and they're on board to enforce it because this only works if it's fully enforced. And look, the other thing about this, you know, the joint committee, there are four players on the committee, Whit Merrifield, Austin Slater, Jack Flaherty, and Tyler Glasnow. And they were representing the interests of all the players. They were talking to all the player reps. They were talking to, you know, every player in the big leagues and in the union. And, you know, they gave us tremendous feedback and I think improved the rule in a number of ways. It went from, you know, 14 seconds with no one on in the minor leagues to 15 seconds, 19 seconds with runners on base in the minor leagues, 20 seconds, hitters having to be in at 9 seconds to 8 seconds, and an additional the disengagement limit is going to reset. You know, when a runner advances, that's new. There's an additional mound visit to make guaranteed for the ninth inning. Is this another way to make sure when the game is late and close and it's different in the big leagues, there's an additional way to slow the game down. And then umpires are given a little bit more discretion under special circumstances to add more time. So I think the players, you know, had legitimate concerns that the big leagues are different than the minor leagues in some respects, and that it's really important to build in some safeguards. Because the whole point of the rule is just to improve the game. We want to make sure that players are able to perform at a high level without incurring violations. You know, the game is about the players and it's for the fans. I said that at the press conference. And if the rule is designed properly after an adjustment period, players are going to be able to do their thing, have their routines and perform as they always have without getting violations. And, you know, keep in mind all the different ways that players can still slow the game down under the new regulations. You know, there's one timeout for every plate appearance for each hitter. So every hitter can call time once per plate appearance, step out, start the clock over. Every pitcher, when there's a runner on base, can step off twice for every plate appearance, then restart the clock and slow things down with impunity. And then if a runner happens to move up with a steal or for a wild pitch pass ball, you know, can step off twice more for every plate appearance. There's those five mound visits and then a guaranteed one in the ninth inning and guaranteed one for every extra inning. That slows the game down and resets the clock as well. And, you know, very seldom does a team run out of mound visits. So that's another tool that can be used. And then the ability to appeal to an umpire for special circumstances. If something happens, you get something in your eye, whatnot, you have the ability to reset the clock that way if the umpire in his discretion thinks you're not trying to circumvent the rule. So we're down to less than half a violation, you know, per game, as I said, between the two teams. I think I think that's a strong indicator, even though things are a little bit more intense in the big leagues, especially late in games and close games, that players will be able to adjust and perform at their accustomed high level, even with this pitch timer going on in the background. And that's the big thing for fans. And then ultimately, even for players, it fades into the background. You're just left with this improved product.
That's what I was about to say. I think the biggest thing for like relievers, because a lot of them are skittish, like, and they don't want to see the clock like going down like 5, 4, 3. So it may be where we may have to make the rule, like when they come set, then the clock turns off. You know what I'm saying? So they don't actually visually see the clock ticking down. Cause I know a lot of guys are going to be like 5, 4, and like they freak out. I like relievers are weird. So I just know that that's going to be one of the things that comes up.
Yeah, no, and I think like just as with the shift rules, I can almost guarantee you there will be modifications, you know, to make the rule better, to make it more manageable for players, to make it more effective. And there's no way that the regulations as drawn up were perfect. No one's saying they are, but they were tested, you know, extensively, and we'll see how it plays in the major leagues. And then certainly, you know, I think the players, this competition committee is not going away. Players will continue to have input, and changes can be made. You know, because players ultimately the ones who have to play with it, and their voice is going to be fundamental to getting the rule right.
It's interesting, the example you give, Theo, of Mark Burley, because one of the things that has struck me, and I think I've talked about it with you at least casually at some point this year, but doing games this year, is how good it feels when you have two starters who are dealing and how awful it feels once you get into the bullpens. Like, I mean, it's, you know, and obviously there's a intimate connection when you're broadcasting a game that you feel when it comes to the rhythm of it. So maybe it makes me hypersensitive to it, but anybody watching a game feels it. Like, there's a certain staccato that comes with two starters dealing, that's a really welcome pace that feels nice, where you're like, wow, this is great. And then all of a sudden you get into the bullpens and it's just like, I mean, sometimes it is just absolutely screeching to a halt. And all of a sudden it feels like something you want to end rather than something that you're enjoying. So the idea that this could sort of almost subliminally create an atmosphere where you feel like you're always watching two Mark Burleys, like, I feel like that's going to be really, really enjoyable for the fan. And it's exciting to think about.
Yeah. And I don't know if you've noticed this in the games you've been broadcasting too, but you know, perhaps you've seen a trend where young pitchers who have been experiencing the rule in the minor leagues are already pitching at a quicker pace because yep. They're used to it, you know, from the minor leagues, which is great.
It's great. It's great. So Theo, is this one that you are like, you're genuinely excited to see come next March what it starts looking like at the big league level?
Yeah, I am. I mean, look, I'm more excited for maybe May on, you know, after I've had a chance to adjust for everything. With anything, there's something so fundamental, you know, that affects every pitch. There's an adjustment period. And I think the polling we did of minor league players, who, first of all, we shouldn't go any further without thanking the minor league players too. Absolutely. For all their cooperation with the rule changes over the years, their continued cooperation in playing with new variables and a new landscape of rules while they're trying to, you know, develop and get to the big leagues. That's a huge asset for us and something that made this all possible. And then they also have given tremendous feedback, filling out surveys and talking to us when we visit minor league parks. So they were great to work with. But what the minor league players said, we asked them how long it took to like really adjust and feel comfortable. I think the most popular answer was like two weeks.
Okay.
Even for something like the pitch timer. So it was either 2 weeks or 3 weeks. But so look, I think next April is going to be uncomfortable for a lot of people, you know, and there are going to be more violations in April than any other month, because that's the way this thing works. We hope that no games are decided because of it, but I am genuinely excited. Like, I'm confident that this is really good for the game and really great for the future of baseball, and that fans are going to love it. And ultimately players are really going to like it too. So I am excited about it. Am I excited for April? Not quite as much as May on, but no, I think this is a huge turning point for baseball. And I applaud everyone involved with, you know, from major league players to minor league players, to the owners and the commissioner, and all the minor league operators, everyone who helped us really test this and get the rules right. Chris Young, who was fundamental to drafting like this tightened up version of the rule with the two disengagements, which we haven't talked about, but that's a pretty important part of the rule because it closed a major loophole. But just apply to everybody because I think this is really going to work. Some form of this is really going to work in the big leagues for a long time.
The two disengagements, Theo, keeps a pitcher from just being able to continually step off.
Yeah, exactly. So previous versions of the pitch timer didn't limit the amount of disengagements, which are either step offs or throwovers. And what it just meant that every time a pitcher was running low on the clock, he would just step off and reset it. And it took all the teeth out of the pitch timer regulations and rendered the rule completely ineffective. So now there's a limit of two free disengagements per plate appearance. And then, you know, if you disengage or throw over a third time, you have to put the runner out or essentially suffer a balk as a result. And I know there's some concern about that, again, mainly from people who haven't seen it, that it'll be impossible to control the running game. And it takes away all pitchers' weapons to control the running game. We have not seen that in the minor leagues. Again, it's why the testing is so important. But you know, AAA is probably the closest analog we have to the big leagues. And we've seen stolen base attempts go up about half an attempt per game. And they went from 1.88 stolen base attempts per game to, I think, 2.34. So about half per game. Stolen base success rate went up 2.5 percentage points in AAA, like I think from 75 to 77.5 or so. So that's with the bigger bases also. So look, in the major leagues, we're averaging only 1.35 stolen base attempts per game. You know, and it's fans' single favorite event in the game. When you poll fans, what are your favorite events in the course of a game? Stolen bases, triples, doubles, great defensive plays. And we're at like a generational low for stolen base attempts. You know, we have not had somebody steal 40 bags in the big leagues for the last three seasons. So like if the bigger bases and the disengagement limit tilts the scales a little bit more, and that's just what we've seen in the minor leagues, is a little bit more in favor of the base stealer, that's probably a good thing. You know, is anyone going to complain if the greatest athletes in the world, you know, someone goes out there and steals 60, 70 bags away, like, you know, Carl Crawford, Ellsbury, and Jose Reyes did 15 years ago, or, you know, heaven forbid someone, you know, someone steals 100, you know, 110, like Ricky Henderson did or Vince Coleman did. And we have players like that back in the game. Like, I don't think anyone's complaining about that. I think that's great for fans to see that kind of athleticism, that kind of action, that kind of suspense on the base paths on a daily basis. So, you know, the disengagement limit is necessary for the pitch timer, but I also think it serves an important policy consideration for us, which is give fans more of what they want. They like stolen base action. It's not going to make life impossible on pitchers. We've seen that in the minor leagues, but it is going to, I think, make fast base runners a little bit more aggressive in picking their spots to go.
Yeah, I don't think with the adjustment, I don't think that April is going to be that bad. I know, like, I think if you guys get on guys early in spring training, I think by April, I think everybody is going to be adjusted because they know the rules coming. You have the joint committee, the player reps have been informed. Like, this is a time when these rule changes are coming, but I feel like everybody's most informed, like all of the players. So they know this is coming. You know what I'm saying? I just think that if we're strict with it at, you know, the league, as far as on the league side, then I think that they'll hop on board with this pretty quick. And I think that they want the fans to be more excited about coming to the ballpark and, you know, to be marketed better. So, you know, I think everybody's on board with these rule changes. I think anyway.
Yeah, no, you make a great point. I mean, players want the game to be more entertaining too. You know, they want a better brand of baseball. They're out there, first of all, 162 times with 3 hours a night. So they're in the middle of it. They want a more exciting game and they want to make the fans happy too. It's just, you know, with certain elements of the rule, it's important to get their feedback and get it right. And it's also important to balance that with making sure the rules are really effective. So see, do you think spring training is going to be real enough to help players adjust, or do you think the adjustment period starts opening day?
No, I think it's spring training. I think as soon as you get them into competition where they have a uniform on and the other team has their uniforms on and they get in the batter's box, I think that's when you start the realness of this is what's going to be like in April. And I think by April, I think everybody will be adjusted. But I think that very first game of spring training, it's got to be bang. This is the rule. 15 seconds, ball one. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's got to be like right on it and let these guys know that it's going to be no leadway. Maybe it will be during the season, but right now these are the rules and this is what it is and get adjusted, because in a month, this is going to really count as a strike or a ball against you.
Yeah, that's the plan. I'm going to have to cancel my trip if it works.
I feel like the bigger bases is the forgotten stepchild of the three major rule changes, or at least the one that is, you know, maybe least discussed or debated. But Theo, the bigger bases, what, you know, what gave you guys conviction in going that direction?
Yeah, so bigger bases, primarily about player safety, but also, you know, encourage a little bit more action on the base paths, because I think we talked about this last time, but you're losing 4.5 inches between first and second and third. But the data was really encouraging, especially on the player safety front. I think that every level where we had the bigger bases, which was all four levels of the minor leagues this year, injuries due to collisions either with the base or with fielders around the base decreased by around 30%. Which is really significant. You know, if you add that up over time, there are a lot of injuries, especially at first base. And if you're taking a 15-inch by 15-inch base and making it 18 inches by 18 inches, you're creating a lot more real estate for the first baseman to maneuver, for the batter runner to maneuver. Same thing with, you know, double play turn, same thing with, you know, stolen bases and sliding into bases. It's just making life a little bit easier on the fielder not to get spiked, making life a little bit easier on the base runner not to jam a finger or turn an ankle. So player safety was, you know, an important consideration, and the data backed that up. And then also, look, you're now reducing the distance between bases, which, you know, no one would ever mess with 90 feet between bases, but the distance actually between the bases was never 90 feet. It was 88 feet, 1.5 inches. And now it's 87 feet, 9 inches, you know? So, those 4.5 inches, mean, you know, it's like the length of your finger. So a lot of those bang, bang plays on replay where you're just out, now you're going to be just safe. And, you know, it's significant. People joke, oh, it's 4.5 inches, not going to make that big of a difference. But like if the decision to stretch a single to a double or to attempt a stolen base, like, you're not going to go if you think you're going to be out by a ton. So let's say it's like 45 inches, like, you know, just under 4 feet is the give or take, like the range of possible outcomes. You're either going to be safe or you're going to be out by, you know, 45 inches or less. It's 10%. You know, you're taking like the last 10% of that and you're taking it from out to safe. It does change a little bit the calculus and allows you to be a little bit more aggressive and still successful on the base paths, which I think is something that we want to see. We want the trip around the bases to be a little bit easier. We want the stolen base calculus to tilt a little bit more in favor of aggressiveness and, you know, even ball in play, like, you know, technically infielders, because it's a little bit closer home to first now, technically you might have to, you know, should play like a few millimeters, an inch or so shallower, that allows more balls to get through. So it's around the margins. But the bigger bases, I think, support the policy directions we're trying to go. And first and foremost is player safety.
This was the one I feel like players at the beginning were like freaked out about, like, oh, yeah, you're changing the game, you're gonna make the bigger bases, all that stuff. And then as I've been talking to players that have played with the bigger bases, they're like, oh, we don't really even notice it. You know what I'm saying? Like, they look like, once you see it, it look a little bigger, but it does encourage, you know, them running the bases more aggressively, stealing bags and all of that stuff. But I feel like at the beginning, like before all of this started, the players were freaking out about the bigger bases the most. And that's the one that they care about the least, to be honest.
Yeah. It's ironic. That's the one that, you know, players ultimately voted for. Yeah. You know, they supported the bigger bases move. So, I think, look, there were a lot of pizza box jokes, you know, going around the minor leagues. I saw Rich Hill the day it was announced had the couch cushion out at third base, you know. But I think ultimately it's going to be good for the game. It's clever, right? Like no one reducing the distance between bases, I think is good for the type of game that we want to see, but no one wants to mess with 90 feet between bases. Not a single manager even knew how big a base was, right? So you're changing something that's not sacred, getting the same intended impact in a subtle, but probably in the long term, meaningful way, and all the while keeping players healthy. So I think that one's a good thing all around.
Theo, I want to ask you about the automated balls and strikes and where we're at with that. But before I do, you know as a fan, I feel great comfort knowing you're in the role you're in now, because I trust your love of the game, your stewardship of it, your vision of it. And so as someone who, you know, wants this sport to thrive forever, I hope you're always a part of the league office and wherever that may lead you. But I wonder for you, it's a very different thing to be in the position you're in now versus what you were, you know, with the Red Sox and with the Cubs for so many years, where you were, you know, I mean, you are in the throes of the highest form of competition and you are winning and losing every single day. What is the level of, you know, satisfaction that you feel right now in this role? And is there a part of your competitive spirit that feels like it just can't be itched, or was it itch so friggin' hard for so long that you're all right if it never gets itched again?
Yeah. Well, first of all, thanks for the kind words. I'll let you change your mind on that if it turns out you don't want to. Look, I think what I like the best is winning, and I love wins and losses. I love the competition and the camaraderie that you get from being part of a big league club. Even the front office, you know, we have our own camaraderie too, in addition to what we're kind of let in on in the clubhouse. And it's amazing. There's nothing like it, you know, but I did it for 30 years. I did it for 18 years running teams. And this is a really welcome break, because the one thing about working for a team is you have to be laser focused on winning. So you're out there, all you care about, it's almost like a fiduciary responsibility to your organization, right, and fan base is find every optimization, do everything you can, find every small advantage to put your team in a position to, you know, to win one more game or, you know, to turn one more ball in play into an out that might win you one more game, that might get you into the postseason, that might win you a World Series. And so you don't have the time or really the interest quite as much in thinking about the game from a fan's perspective. Like, you're not concerned with how pretty the game is. You don't go home at night, you know, after a close win saying like, man, that was a pretty game. You're just like, that was a win. I don't care if it was ugly.
I don't care how long it was. Yeah.
That's a W. Now I can maybe get a little sleep, because if it was a loss, I was staying up all night thinking about it. So you just don't have the chance to think about the game through the fans' eyes. And honestly, you know, a lot of people like me were helped influence or create some of these optimizations that, while they helped your team win on the field and help players perform in certain areas, it was detrimental in a lot of important ways, like to the aesthetic of the game, to the entertainment value of the game. So it's a nice break to be able to say like, okay, for me right now, winning doesn't matter. I don't have to look at the game only through that lens. I get to look at the game through the lens of the fan. And what is, you know, the best, most entertaining version of baseball? What's gonna make baseball more and more relevant on a daily basis in this country? I think, like, we're a better country when baseball is, you know, dominating the sports conversation, and there's so many positive things going on in the game right now. But the game the last, you know, 10, 20 years or so has changed a lot, and it's evolved in a way that none of us would have drawn it up that way. If we were sitting down 20 years ago to say, hey, how do we want the game to look like in 20 years? We never would have said, hey, let's design a game where the league gets 243. instead of 268. Like, right, no one would have done that. No one would have said, let's design a game where the average pitcher strikes out more hitters than Bob Gibson, because that'd be a ton of fun if, like, the ball's never in play. No one would have set out to design a game that said, you know, let's make, you know, fans' favorite plays are stolen bases, triples, and doubles. Let's design a game where there's generational lows in all three of those areas, and they don't happen anymore. Let's design a game where the ball's only in play once every 4 minutes. So that's happened. You know, some of the optimizations that front offices and people like me have been, you know, partially or fully responsible for in some ways have contributed to those negative trends. So, man, what a privilege and an honor to be able to have a small seat at the table to try to be a little bit intentional about how the next changes in the game are going to get us back to a more entertaining, better version of the game, give fans more of what they like, less of what they dislike, put the players in the center of the action instead of the front offices. You know, front offices are great and they do important work, but like the game on the field, I think you want controlled by players, not necessarily by algorithms that are spit up in the front office or controlled too much by decision making from the front office. And then, you know, bring baseball back to a form that's relatable to all of us, that's familiar to the game, you know, that most of us grew up with. So I really appreciate the commissioner inviting me to play a small part in that conversation. Does it scratch all those itches? The competition and the camaraderie? No, but you know, maybe I'll have another act with the team someday and I can get back to that. But to have a chance to spend a little bit more time with my kids and to, you know, have a seat at the table in these important discussions that I think are going to be great for baseball in the long run, man, that's, I wouldn't ask for anything more.
That's awesome.
That's great, man. Yeah. So it sounds like, I feel like, you know, maybe 7-10 years we'll reevaluate, Theo. That's what I'm thinking. You're going to see.
That's a long time. That's a long time.
So Theo, how about the automated balls and strikes? Is this something, I mean, what are you guys seeing from it? I know came back when he saw it. Was it in Tampa where you saw it, C?
It was a challenge system game that I went to see.
Challenge system.
Yeah. I haven't seen a fully ABS game, call game yet.
What are you seeing right now, Theo, with it?
Yeah. Before I get into ABS, I think it's important to note that, you know, there were a lot of rule changes being experimented with in the minor leagues, and proved to be effective enough and popular enough and inintrusive enough that they were ultimately, you know, voted on and approved by the committee, the three that we've talked about. Some were sort of had unintended consequences or proved to be too onerous for players, and they were discarded. And we, you know, on the cutting room floor, like the step off rule is a good example, like eliminating the left-handed pitcher's ability to do the hang and go to first move like that. No one ended up liking that. It didn't work. So we got rid of it. And then there's another category of changes that just require more testing to make sure you get it just right. And I think ABS falls under that category and appropriately, because ABS affects the essence of every game. It affects every pitch. There's nothing more important in baseball than the strike zone. And so any change to the way balls and strikes are called, I think requires, even more testing, even more consideration of unintended consequences, and even more confidence that ultimately, you know, the strike zone you're working with is right. The mechanism by which that you're going to use to call balls and strikes is appropriate, fair to all parties, and continues to capture the essence of baseball. So we learned a lot in ABS testing this year. Probably the biggest development in ABS testing in 2022 was what CC referred to, which is the development and momentum behind an alternate mechanism for ABS, which is the challenge system. So there's sort of two different methods being tested this year and ultimately continue to be tested next year. And that's full ABS, which is a system by which every single pitch is called by the automated system and then delivered to the home plate umpire near instantaneously through an earpiece. And then the home plate umpire relays the call from the ABS system, ball or strikes. That's full ABS.
And that's I thought that's what I was for. I thought I wanted full ABS, but I'll let him explain the rest.
Yeah. And then so the alternate system, because full ABS gets every pitch right, but the testing we've done so far indicate we need to do more, but it indicates it does come with a number of other impacts, some of which may or may not be as desirable as this sort of panacea of like getting every pitch correct. So I'll get into that in a second. But so we thought it was worthwhile to experiment with an alternate mechanism for automated balls and strikes. And that's where the challenge system was born. It really mimics something that had been in place for a long time in tennis. And under the challenge system, the home plate umpire continues to call balls and strikes as normal with the ABS system running in the background. And under the challenge system, each team would have three challenges per game, where the pitcher, the hitter, or the catcher, after a pitch that's questionable, could immediately signal the home plate umpire that he was challenging the call on the field. The home plate umpire would turn around, again, instantaneous. It takes less than 5 seconds, you know, only a handful of seconds, would get either confirmation that his call was right or would get the reversal through the ABS system announced in his ear. And then the call would be right. And if the team that makes the challenge is correct and the challenge is overturned, which happened between, you know, like depending what level you were looking at, like 41 to 47% of the time, like if the challenge was correct and the call was overturned, you would retain your challenge. So each team gets three challenges per game, but if you're right, you keep them. If you're wrong, you lose them. And so what that led to was that a more familiar style of play. So, you know, the theory is that it takes the best of full ABS in that, you know, all the egregious calls are going to be challenged and corrected. So any like bad miss, how could he have called that? An obvious mistake by the home plate umpire that gets challenged and overturned. And then any big call, you know, any questionable ball strike call in a high leverage situation, if the team uses their challenges appropriately, those big calls would be corrected as well. And at the same time, you don't lose the human element. It's a pretty big change to go from, you know, human beings, you know, umpiring the game, calling balls and strikes, to now, you know, completely run every single pitch called by an automated system. There are other benefits of human beings calling balls and strikes. You know, we talked earlier about some potential unintended consequences of full ABS. The human zone is elastic. It on average grows by about, you know, 10% in three ball counts, for example, like 3-0 counts. The zone's a little bit bigger. The home plate umpire tends to, you know, keep the game moving. We'll call a strike on a borderline call. In two strike situations, the zone shrinks by about 10%. And what that does is it tends to be a bit of a governor on strikeout and walk rate. And when you have an inelastic strike zone, so the strike zone never changes, which is what you see with full ABS, it has potentially may have the unintended consequence of spiking the strikeout rate a little bit, maybe even spiking the walk rate a little bit, because there's no consideration given whatsoever to the count or to keeping the game moving. And, you know, the human called strike zone actually looks more almost like an oval. It's got rounded corners because it's almost impossible for human beings to call the extreme four corners of the strike zone. Of course, with full ABS, every pitch, you know, even one that catches the far extremity of the corner, if it nicks any of the strike zone, even, you know, a millimeter, that's a strike. And so the phenomenon of every single pitch in the strike zone being called a strike is also another threat to boost in the strikeout rate, which is not the direction we want to go. And then finally, you know, the impact of full ABS on the catching position. You know, catching has evolved in a certain way where, you know, framing is a really important part of the job, receiving the pitch in a manner that allows it to be considered a strike and present the pitch the right way is a big part of what catchers have trained for and how catchers make their living. And going to full ABS would, you know, in one instant, fully eradicate framing as a skill and completely transform the catching position to emphasize you know, other elements of the game. I think it'd become more of a bat first position right away. Blocking and throwing would still be really important, but framing would be completely out the window. In fact, even the way catchers set up to receive pitches would probably change quite a bit. So there's a bit of a fairness consideration, you know, with all the catchers out there. And so, you know, what we found is that the ABS talent system is wildly popular with players, even with umpires, who really like it. But, you know, so far the challenge system polls a lot better than full ABS does, you know, with those who have experienced both. And it just means we need to really continue to test both systems. We need to refine the strike zone. We made a lot of strides this year with the strike zone by going to a two-dimensional zone set at the middle of the plate. It's created a little bit fairer treatment for fastballs that carry through the zone at the bottom of the zone and breaking balls. You know, we had a problem past iterations of ABS with breaking balls that just clip the bottom of the zone at the very front of the plate and end up in the dirt, but are called strikes. That's been improved significantly with the strike zone this year. I think we've got a pretty good feel for where the top and bottom of the zone are set. We're still experimenting a little bit with width and the ramifications of different widths. So the bottom line is it's been really encouraging. You know, the challenge system is potentially, you know, a viable alternative. I think there's still strong arguments in favor of the status quo, strong arguments in favor of full ABS, and strong arguments in favor of the challenge system. We'll learn a lot more. I think there's going to be robust testing of all the different methods, continued refinement of the strike zone in next year and potentially in coming years. But I think we'll learn an awful lot next year. And at this time next year, we'll be much better positioned to say with confidence, you know, the joint committee will be anyway, what moves us closer to the best version of baseball? Is it the status quo? Is it something similar to full ABS? Something that, is a bit of a hedge, like the challenge system. And we'll get more feedback and input from players. You know, I'm excited for a lot of AAA players and therefore, you know, big league players who go back and forth or on rehab assignment to experience, the challenge system in full ABS and give their feedback.
I can see why you ended up liking the challenge system as much as you did, C.
Yeah, because... I like the challenge system better. I just wish that we had more. Like, I think you could have a challenge, an inning, or a challenge in at bat. You know what I'm saying? Imagine how many times Aaron Judge gets that low fastball called on him, and then you just tap the back of his helmet, and they can get it right. You know, it's so fast, that, you know.
It's a balance, though, because if you have too many challenges – then even though the challenges are quick, like under 5 seconds,
then there will be ABS again.
I think we want to make sure that, you know, you're not as a fan, you're not experienced constant challenges that interrupt the flow of the game. And we thought, you know, we decided to start conservative and start with three, again, allowing the team to keep them if they're right. And it actually worked pretty well. Like, I think when we did our survey at the end of the year, most players, even hitters, you know, we're happy with three, you know, maybe one more or guarantee one that's there in the ninth inning. But it actually worked out pretty well because it also, you know, one thing I like about challenge is it creates accountability for umpires, and umpires actually kind of liked, or not, I don't want to overgeneralize, but a lot of umpires like the challenge system. And working with ABS and then the challenge, it kind of helped them refine their zone a little bit. And they want to be right.
Yeah.
You know, umpires always want to be right, but you especially want to be right, you know, when there's a challenge system at play. And so it helped them refine their zone, and they're still calling balls and strikes, which is huge for them. It's what they take the most pride in. I lost my train of thought there for a second, but umpires obviously creates accountability for umpires, and it creates accountability for players too. Because there's nothing's going to hurt a team worse than frivolous challenges. Like, you know, you get up there in your first at bat and, you know, you think you get hosed by a call. Now you start challenging left and right, and you cost your team two of their three challenges, or you burn all three challenges. And now the team doesn't have its challenges for the high leverage at bats late in the game.
Like, right.
That's rough. So in cricket, there's one cricket league that has one challenge per game. And the custom as I understand it, has evolved so that, like, if a player just reactively or emotionally gives a frivolous challenge and he turns out he's wrong, so he costs his team that challenge, he's got to watch the rest of the game in the stands. So I don't think we're going to be seeing that, but it does underscore the importance of and rewards smart players, team first players, players who understand situational baseball and percentage baseball. And, you know, you're not going to, with two outs and nobody on, you know, if first pitch of an at bat, borderline call, you're probably better off not challenging that, you know, save it for a bigger situation, or save it for a call where, you know, you're 100% right, or higher leverage count in a higher leverage at bat. And teams are going to be rewarded for under a challenge system. Teams would be rewarded for selecting players who get that, who are smart and team first and a little bit more selfless. And if you have, you know, too many selfish players who are brazen with their challenges, it could really impact you.
Everybody back there tapping their helmet.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting because even me as a fan, I'm thinking, you know, if my team blows all three challenges and then has an awful, you know, 1-1 pitch called a strike in a key situation in the ninth inning, and it should be a ball, I'm not going to bitch and moan the same way I would, because I'm going to say, well, guess what, knucklehead? You shouldn't have gotten the other three things wrong throughout the rest of the game, you know?
So teams, we saw in the minor leagues already, and this will be increased exponentially in the big leagues, but teams in the minor leagues were having meetings about smart times to challenge and times when it's smart not to challenge.
And
teams
were putting up challenge. Who can challenge?
Yeah. Who can challenge? Who should challenge? Who shouldn't challenge? Teams are putting up charts in the dugout.
Wow.
Like, you know, different count and game situations and color coded. You know, helping players understand the right times to challenge and not. So, yeah, I think in the big leagues, it'll, if it ever comes to pass, and you know, we're not close to that. Obviously, we're going to learn so much through increased testing of all the different systems going forward. But if it ever did get to the big leagues, obviously it would be down to a science, and your ability to effectively use the challenge system would be an important component of winning, whether you're, you know, a manager, a GM building a team, or a player putting it into place on the field.
Yeah, that was the biggest thing that I noticed while I was down there, was like, them who can challenge. Like, it was one coach who was like, well, my starter can't challenge, but I let my backup challenge all the time. So it's like, you'll get to see who the manager or who the organization thinks is a smarter player.
Yeah. You don't want to be that guy who's not allowed to challenge.
Who's not allowed to challenge.
Asking some deeper questions. But, you know, the other thing, we haven't talked about it from a fan's perspective, but, you know, look, if you told fans there's a system that can correct egregious calls, so like any really obvious missed call is going to be challenged and corrected. It can correct big calls, so high leverage calls are very likely to be challenged and corrected. You know, would fans like that? I think generally so far it pulls pretty well. And then the other thing is the fans get into it. You know, we saw this first in tennis, where I don't know if you guys have ever gone to the US Open or attended a tennis match before, but every time there's a challenge, like you think it's the most exciting part of the game, even though it's not, but fans are like, you know, all into the Jumbotron, clapping, waiting for the outcome, and then give a big ooh and ah when it's revealed. And the same thing's already happened in baseball, where we've rolled it out on a limited basis in AAA. You know, the challenge goes up, everyone starts paying attention to the scoreboard, the pit, you know, a digital recreation of the pitch and where it ended up, just off the plate or just on the plate comes in, and fans get really into it. So, you know, look, as long as it's really quick, it could be an enhancement of the fan experience as well.
Theo, this was so wonderful, man. Thank you for giving us so much time, for coming back on. You know, I'm sure at some point in the not too distant future, we'll hit you up for a third iteration, but this is just, I know for our audience, this is so valuable, especially after them hearing you set the table for what we were sort of examining in the minor leagues, and now coming back with the reactions and also letting us in on why what was implemented for next season. It gives us all an informed lens. So thank you so much for the time, for continuing to dedicate yourself to improving you know, our game, and for putting up with my co-host as your colleague at the MLB offices now, Theo.
Hey, CC walks on water at MLB, so he's, yeah, right. I'm just following him. He's the lead blocker. I'm just going in the holes he creates.
That sounds about right. That sounds about right. Well, Theo, thank you so much, man. Enjoy, the rest of the fall and the lead up to the playoffs, and then October as well, where you won't have to worry about stressing winning and losing.
Yeah. No, we haven't talked. We didn't talk enough about the 2022 season, how incredible it's been.
Yeah.
Some of the individual performances are unbelievable, and that's how I think about these rule changes. Is like, look, we've got the greatest athletes in the history of the game playing the game right now. More people are watching baseball right now than ever had. There's so much great content out there. There's so many stars. Like, again, the game is about the players and it's for the fans. And if these rule changes make it even more about the players because they're right in the middle of the action, you lose some of the dead time, you lose some of the stuff that's not action. And then you end up with these rule changes with more of the things the fans like about the game and less of what they dislike. And that's a home run. So it's not going to be perfect. We're going to have to make adjustments along the way as we go. We appreciate the cooperation and input from all the players. We appreciate the fans, bearing with us with things that are going to be new to them. But I think if we all work on this together and have a little patience in the end, we're going to end up with a more action-packed, more entertaining version of baseball for us all to enjoy, maybe even attract some new fans because of it. Some of the younger fans are really digital fans these days, and you give them more action, less dead time, faster moving game. It's great for the sport in the long run. So I appreciate you guys digging in on it with me and look forward to next time too.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Theo. This was great, man.
All right, guys. Yep. Take care. It was fun.
I just love that conversation. Theo is incredible the way he is able to share detail and distill complicated things in easy to understand ways with incredible support. So I hope you enjoyed that conversation as much as CeCe and I did. Want to let you know, CeCe and I are going to be all over everything hoops. As soon as the World Series wraps, going to get on some significant NBA guests throughout the NBA season. So we'll be all over that. The drama with the Nets, the drama with the Lakers and their rough starts. Ja, potential early MVP, what's been going on with the Grizzlies. Some of the other teams have looked great thus far. Milwaukee, they just look like a monster and they don't even have Middleton yet. We'll be all over all of it. We'll have some great guests as well. In the meantime, we'll stay on this World Series for you. Thanks for listening. Big thanks to Jackson, to Atta, to Sadie, our fearless leaders guiding us through. And we'll see you next week, everybody. New episodes every Thursday, bonus episodes as well. Peace.